Chapter 4 On Camporalon 13 They were through. The entry station had shrunk to a rapidly dimming star behind them, and in a couple of hours they would be crossing the cloud layer. A gravitic ship did not have to break its path by a long route of slow spiral contraction, but neither could it swoop downward too rapidly. Freedom from gravity did not mean freedom from air resistance. The ship could descend in a straight line, but it was still a matter for caution. It could not be too fast. "Where are we going to go?" asked Pellerat, looking confused. "I can't tell one place in the clouds from another, old fellow." "No more can I," said Trevise. "But we have an official holographic map of Camporalon, which gives the shape of the land masses and an exaggerated relief for both land heights and ocean depths, and political subdivisions, too. The map is in the computer, and that will do the work. It will match the planetary land-sea design to the map, thus orienting the ship properly, and it will then take us to the capital by a cycloidic pathway." Pellerat said, "If we go to the capital, we plunge immediately into the political vortex. If the world is anti-foundation, as the fellow at the entry station implied, we'll be asking for trouble. On the other hand, it's bound to be the intellectual center of the planet, and if we want information, that's where we'll find it, if anywhere. As for being anti-foundation, I doubt that they will be able to display that too openly. The mayor may have no great liking for me, but neither can she afford to have a councilman mistreated. She would not care to allow the precedent to be established." Bliss had emerged from the toilet, her hands still damp from scrubbing. She adjusted her underclothes with no sign of concern and said, "By the way, I trust the excreta is thoroughly recycled." "No choice," said Trevise. "How long do you suppose our water supply would last without recycling of excreta? On what do you think those choicely flavored yeast cakes that we eat to lend spice to our frozen staples grow? I hope that doesn't spoil your appetite, my efficient Bliss."
"Why should it? Where do you suppose food and water come from on Gaia, or on this planet, or on Terminus?"
"On Gaia," said Trevise, "the excreta is, of course, as alive as you are."
"Not alive, conscious. There is a difference. The level of consciousness is naturally very low."
Trevise sniffed in a disparaging way, but didn't try to answer. He said, "I'm going into the pilot room to keep the computer company. Not that it needs me."
Pellerat said, "May we come in and help you keep it company? I can't quite get used to the fact that it can get us down all by itself, that it can sense other ships or storms or whatever."
Trevise smiled broadly. "Get used to it, please. The ship is far safer under the computer's control than it ever would be under mine. But certainly, come on. It will do you good to watch what happens." They were over the sunlit side of the planet now, for, as Trevise explained, the map in the computer could be more easily matched to reality in the sunlight than in the dark.
"That's obvious," said Pellerat.
"Not at all obvious. The computer will judge just as rapidly by the infrared light, which the surface radiates even in the dark. However, the longer waves of infrared don't allow the computer quite the resolution that visible light would. That is, the computer doesn't see quite as finely and sharply by infrared. And where necessity doesn't drive, I like to make things as easy as possible for the computer."
"What if the capital is on the dark side?"
"The chance is 50-50, said Trevise. "But if it is, once the map is matched by daylight, we can skim down to the capital quite unerringly, even if it is in the dark. And long before we come anywhere near the capital, we'll be intersecting microwave beams, and we'll be receiving messages directing us to the most convenient spaceport. There's nothing to worry about."
"Are you sure," said Bliss, "you're bringing me down without papers and without any native world that these people here will recognize, and I'm bound and determined not to mention Gaia to them in any case. So what do we do if I'm asked for my papers once we're on the surface?"
Trevise said, "That's not likely to happen. Everyone will assume that was taken care of at the entry station."
"But if they ask..."
"Then, when that time comes, we'll face the problem. Meanwhile, let's not manufacture problems out of air."
"By the time we face the problems that may arise, it might well be too late to solve them."
"I'll rely on my ingenuity to keep it from being too late."
"Talking about ingenuity, how did you get us through the entry station?" Trevise looked at Bliss and let his lips slowly expand into a smile that made him seem like an impish teenager.
Just brains.
Pellerat said, What did you do, old man?
Trevise said, It was a matter of appealing to him in the correct manner. I tried threats and subtle bribes. I had appealed to his logic and his loyalty to the Foundation. Nothing worked, so I fell back on the last resort. I said that you were cheating on your wife, Pellerat.
My wife? But, my dear fellow, I don't have a wife at the moment.
I know that, but he didn't.
Bliss said, By wife, I presume you mean a woman who is a particular man's regular companion?
Trevise said, A little more than that, Bliss. A legal companion, one with enforceable rights in consequence of that companionship.
Pellerat said nervously, Bliss, I do not have a wife. I have had one now and then in the past, but I haven't had one for quite a while. If you would care to undergo the legal ritual...
Oh, Pell, said Bliss, making a sweeping away movement with her right hand. What would I care about that? I have innumerable companions that are as close to me as your arm is close companion to your other arm. It is only isolates who feel so alienated that they have to use artificial conventions to enforce a feeble substitute for true companionship.
But I am an isolate, Bliss, dear. You will be less isolate in time, Pell. Never truly Gaia, perhaps, but less isolate, and you will have a flood of companions.
I only want you, Bliss, said Pell.
That's because you know nothing about it. You'll learn.
Trevise was concentrating on the view screen during that exchange with a look of strained tolerance on his face. The cloud cover had come up close, and for a moment all was gray fog. Microwave vision, he thought, and the computer switched at once to the detection of radar echoes. The clouds disappeared, and the surface of Camporalon appeared in false color, the boundaries between sectors of different constitution a little fuzzy and wavering.
"Is that the way it's going to look from now on?" asked Bliss with some astonishment.
"Only till we drift below the clouds, then it's back to sunlight." Even as he spoke, the sunshine and normal visibility returned.
"I see," said Bliss. Then turning toward him, But what I don't see is why it should matter to that official at the entry station whether Pell was deceiving his wife or not.
If that fellow Kendray had held you back, the news, I said, might reach Terminus, and therefore Pellerat's wife. Pellerat would then be in trouble. I didn't specify the sort of trouble he would be in, but I tried to sound as though it would be bad. There is a kind of Freemasonry among males. Trevise was grinning now. And one male doesn't betray another fellow male. He would even help if requested. The reasoning, I suppose, is that it might be the helper's turn next to be helped. I presume, he added, turning a bit graver, that there is a similar Freemasonry among women. But not being a woman, I have never had an opportunity to observe it closely. Bliss's face resembled a pretty thundercloud.
Is this a joke? She demanded.
No, I'm serious, said Trevise. I don't say that that Kendray fellow let us through only to help Janoff avoid angering his wife. The masculine Freemasonry may simply have added the last push to my other arguments.
But that is horrible. It is its rules that hold society together and bind it into a whole. Is it such a light thing to disregard the rules for trivial reasons?
Well, said Trevise in instant defensiveness, some of the rules are themselves trivial. Few worlds are very particular about passage in and out of their space in times of peace and commercial prosperity, such as we have now, thanks to the Foundation. Camporalon, for some reason, is out of step, probably because of an obscure matter of internal politics. Why should we suffer over that?
That is beside the point. If we only obey those rules that we think are just and reasonable, then no rule will stand, for there is no rule that some will not think is unjust and unreasonable. And if we wish to push our own individual advantage as we see it, then we will always find reason to believe that some hampering rule is unjust and unreasonable. What starts then as a shrewd trick ends in anarchy and disaster, even for the shrewd trickster, since he too will not survive the collapse of society.
Trevise said, Society will not collapse that easily. You speak as Gaia, and Gaia cannot possibly understand the association of free individuals.
Rules established with reason and justice can easily outlive their usefulness as circumstances change, yet can remain in force through inertia. It is then not only right but useful to break those rules as a way of advertising the fact that they have become useless or even actually harmful. Then every thief and murderer can argue he is serving humanity. You go to extremes. In the superorganism of Gaia, there is automatic consensus on the rules of society, and it occurs to no one to break them. One might as well say that Gaia vegetates and fossilizes. There is admittedly an element of disorder in free association, but that is the price one must pay for the ability to induce novelty and change. On the whole, it's a reasonable price. Bliss's voice rose a notch. You are quite wrong if you think Gaia vegetates and fossilizes. Our deeds, our ways, our views are under constant self-examination. They do not persist out of inertia, beyond reason. Gaia learns by experience and thought, and therefore changes when that is necessary. Even if what you say is so, the self-examination and learning must be slow, because nothing but Gaia exists on Gaia. Here, in freedom, even when almost everyone agrees, there are bound to be a few who disagree. And in some cases, those few may be right. And if they are clever enough, enthusiastic enough, right enough, they will win out in the end and be heroes in future ages. Like Harry Seldon, who perfected psychohistory, pitted his own thoughts against the entire galactic empire, and won. He has won only so far, Trevise. The second empire he planned for will not come to pass. There will be Galaxia instead. Will there? Said Trevise grimly. It was your decision, and however much you argue with me in favor of isolates and of their freedom to be foolish and criminal, there is something in the hidden recesses of your mind that forced you to agree with me, us, Gaia, when you made your choice. What is present in the hidden recesses of my mind, said Trevise, more grimly still, is what I seek. There, to begin with, he added, pointing to the viewscreen where a great city spread out to the horizon, a cluster of low structures climbing to occasional heights, surrounded by fields that were brown under a light frost. Pellerat shook his head. Too bad. I meant to watch the approach, but I got caught up in listening to the argument. Trevise said, Never mind, Janoff. You can watch when we leave. I'll promise to keep my mouth shut then, if you can persuade Bliss to control her own. And the far star descended a microwave beam to a landing at the spaceport. 14. Kendray looked grave when he returned to the entry station and watched the far star pass through. He was still clearly depressed at the close of his shift. He was sitting down to his closing meal of the day when one of his mates, a gangling fellow with wide-set eyes, thin light hair, and eyebrows so blonde they seemed absent, sat down next to him. What's wrong, Ken? Said the other. Kendray's lips twisted. He said, That was a gravitic ship that just passed through, Gattis. The odd-looking one with zero radioactivity? That's why it wasn't radioactive. No fuel. Gravitic. Gattis nodded his head. What we were told to watch for, right? Right. And you got it. Leave it to you to be the lucky one. Not so lucky. A woman without identification was on it, and I didn't report her. What? Look, don't tell me. I don't want to know about it. Not another word. You may be a pal, but I'm not going to make myself an accomplice after the fact. I'm not worried about that. Not very much. I had to send the ship down. They want that gravitic, or any gravitic. You know that. Sure, but you could at least have reported the woman. Didn't like to. She's not married. She was just picked up for use. How many men on board? Two. And they just picked her up for that? They must be from Terminus. That's right. They don't care what they do on Terminus. That's right. Disgusting. And they get away with it. One of them was married, and he didn't want his wife to know. If I reported her, his wife would find out. Wouldn't she be back on Terminus? Of course, but she'd find out anyway. Served the fellow right if his wife did find out. I agree,
but I can't be the one to be responsible for it.
They'll hammer you for not reporting it. Not wanting to make trouble for a guy is no excuse.
Would you have reported him?
I'd have had to, I suppose.
No, you wouldn't. The government wants that ship.
If I had insisted on putting the woman on report, the men on the ship would have changed their minds about landing and would have pulled away to some other planet. The government wouldn't have wanted that.
But will they believe you?
I think so. A very cute-looking woman, too. Imagine a woman like that being willing to come along with two men, and married men with the nerve to take advantage. You know, it's tempting.
I don't think you'd want the missus to know you said that, or even thought that.
Kendray said defiantly, "Who's going to tell her, you?"
"Come on, you know better than that."
Gaddis's look of indignation faded quickly, and he said, "It's not going to do those guys any good, you know, you letting them through."
"I know.
The people down surface way will find out soon enough, and even if you get away with it, they won't."
"I know," said Kendray, "but I'm sorry for them. Whatever trouble the woman will make for them will be as nothing to what the ship will make for them. The captain made a few remarks."
Kendray paused, and Gaddis said eagerly, "Like what?"
"Never mind," said Kendray. "If it comes out, it's my butt."
"I'm not going to repeat it."
"Neither am I. But I'm sorry for those two men from Terminus."
15. To anyone who has been in space and experienced its changelessness, the real excitement of spaceflight comes when it is time to land on a new planet. The ground speeds backward under you as you catch glimpses of land and water, of geometrical areas and lines that might represent fields and roads. You become aware of the green of growing things, the gray of concrete, the brown of bare ground, the white of snow. Most of all, there is the excitement of populated conglomerates, cities which, on each world, have their own characteristic geometry and architectural variants. In an ordinary ship, there would have been the excitement of touching down and skimming across a runway. For the Far Star, it was different. It floated through the air, was slowed by skillfully balancing air resistance and gravity, and finally made to come to rest above the spaceport. The wind was gusty, and that introduced an added complication. The Far Star, when adjusted to low response to gravitational pull, was not only abnormally low in weight, but in mass as well. If its mass were too close to zero, the wind would blow it away rapidly. Hence, gravitational response had to be raised, and jet thrusts had to be delicately used, not only against the planet's pull, but against the wind's push, and in a manner that matched the shift in wind intensity closely. Without an adequate computer, it could not possibly have been done properly. Downward and downward, with small unavoidable shifts in this direction and that, drifted the ship, until it finally sank into the outlined area that marked its assigned position in the port. The sky was a pale blue, intermingled with flat white, when the Far Star landed. The wind remained gusty, even at ground level, and though it was now no longer a navigational peril, it produced a chill that Trevise winced at. He realized at once that their clothing supply was totally unsuited to Comparellian weather. Pellerat, on the other hand, looked about with appreciation and drew his breath deeply through his nose with relish, liking the bite of the cold, at least for the moment. He even deliberately unseamed his coat in order to feel the wind against his chest. In a little while, he knew, he would seam up again and adjust his scarf, but for now he wanted to feel the existence of an atmosphere. One never did aboard ship. Bliss drew her coat closely about herself and with gloved hands dragged her hat down to cover her ears. Her face was crumpled in misery and she seemed close to tears. She muttered, "This world is evil. It hates and mistreats us."
"Not at all, Bliss, dear," said Pellerat earnestly. "I'm sure the inhabitants like this world and that it, likes them, if you want to put it that way. We'll be indoors soon enough and it will be warm there."
Almost as an afterthought, he flipped one side of his coat outward and curved it about her, while she snuggled against his shirt front. Trevise did his best to ignore the temperature. He obtained a magnetized card from the port authority, checking it on his pocket computer to make sure that it gave the necessary details, his aisle and lot number, the name and engine number of his ship, and so on. He checked once more to make sure that the ship was tightly secured, and then took out the maximum insurance allowed against the chance of misadventure. Useless, actually, since the Far Star should be invulnerable at the likely Comparellian level of technology, and was entirely irreplaceable at whatever price if it were not. Trevise found the taxi station where it ought to be. A number of the facilities at spaceports were standardized in position, appearance, and manner of use. They had to be in view of the multi-world nature of the clientele. He signaled for a taxi, punching out the destination merely as City. A taxi glided up to them on diamagnetic skis, drifting slightly under the impulse of the wind and trembling under the vibration of its not-quite-silent engine. It was a dark gray in color and bore its white taxi insignia on the back doors. The taxi driver was wearing a dark coat and a white furred hat. Pellerat, becoming aware, said softly, "The planetary decor seems to be black and white." Trevise said, "It may be more lively in the city proper." The driver spoke into a small microphone, perhaps in order to avoid opening the window. "Going to the city, folks?" There was a gentle sing-song to his galactic dialect that was rather attractive, and he was not hard to understand, always a relief on a new world. Trevise said, "That's right," and the rear door slid open. Bliss entered, followed by Pellerat, and then by Trevise. The door closed, and warm air welled upward. Bliss rubbed her hands and breathed a long sigh of relief. The taxi pulled out slowly, and the driver said, "That ship you came in is gravitic, isn't it?" Trevise said dryly, "Considering the way it came down, would you doubt it?" The driver said, "Is it from Terminus, then?" Trevise said, "Do you know any other world that could build one?" The driver seemed to digest that as the taxi took on speed. He then said, "Do you always answer a question with a question?" Trevise couldn't resist. "Why not?" "In that case, how would you answer me if I asked if your name were Golan Trevise?" "I would answer, what makes you ask?" The taxi came to a halt at the outskirts of the spaceport, and the driver said, "Curiosity. I ask again, are you Golan Trevise?" Trevise's voice became stiff and hostile. "What business is that of yours?" "My friend," said the driver, "we're not moving till you answer the question. And if you don't answer in a clear yes or no in about 2 seconds, I'm turning the heat off in the passenger compartment, and we'll keep on waiting. Are you Golan Trevise, councilman of Terminus? If your answer is in the negative, you will have to show me your identification papers." Trevise said, "Yes, I am Golan Trevise, and as a councilman of the Foundation, I expect to be treated with all the courtesy due my rank. Your failure to do so will have you in hot water, fellow. Now what?" "Now we can proceed a little more lightheartedly." The taxi began to move again. "I choose my passengers carefully, and I had expected to pick up 2 men only. The woman was a surprise, and I might have made a mistake. As it is, if I have you, then I can leave it to you to explain the woman when you reach your destination." "You don't know my destination." "As it happens, I do. You're going to the Department of Transportation." "That's not where I want to go." "That matters not one little bit, Councilman. If I were a taxi driver, I'd take you where you want to go. Since I'm not, I take you where I want you to go." "Pardon me," said Pellerat, leaning forward. "You certainly seem to be a taxi driver. You're driving a taxi." "Anyone might drive a taxi. Not everyone has a license to do so. And not every car that looks like a taxi is a taxi." Trevise said, "Let's stop playing games. Who are you, and what are you doing? Remember that you'll have to account for this to the Foundation." "Not I," said the driver. "My superiors, perhaps. I'm an agent of the Comparellian Security Force. I am under orders to treat you with all due respect to your rank, but you must go where I take you. And be very careful how you react, for this vehicle is armed, and I am under orders to defend myself against attack.
16. The vehicle, having reached cruising speed, moved with absolute smooth quiet, and Trevise sat there in quietness as frozen. He was aware, without actually looking, of Pellerat glancing at him now and then, with a look of uncertainty on his face, a "What do we do now? Please tell me" look. Bliss, a quick glance told him, sat calmly, apparently unconcerned. Of course, she was a whole world in herself. All of Gaia, though it might be at galactic distances, was wrapped up in her skin. She had resources that could be called on in a true emergency. But then what had happened? Clearly, the official at the entry station, following routine, had sent down his report, omitting Bliss, and it had attracted the interest of the security people and, of all things, the Department of Transportation. Why? It was peacetime, and he knew of no specific tensions between Kamporalan and the Foundation. He himself was an important Foundation official. Wait. He had told the official at the entry station, Kendray his name had been, that he was on important business with the Kamporalian government. He had stressed that in his attempt to get through. Kendray must have reported that as well, and that would rouse all sorts of interest. He hadn't anticipated that, and he certainly should have. What then about his supposed gift of rightness? Was he beginning to believe that he was the black box that Gaia thought he was, or said it thought he was? Was he being led into a quagmire by the growth of an overconfidence built on superstition? How could he for one moment be trapped in that folly? Had he never in his life been wrong? Did he know what the weather would be tomorrow? Did he win large amounts in games of chance? The answers were no, no, and no. Well, then, was it only in the large, inchoate things that he was always right? How could he tell? Forget that. After all, the mere fact that he had stated he had important state business. No, it was Foundation security that he had said. Well, then, the mere fact that he was there on a matter of Foundation security, coming as he had secretly and unheralded, would surely attract their attention. Yes, but until they knew what it was all about, they would surely act with the utmost circumspection. They would be ceremonious and treat him as a high dignitary. They would not kidnap him and make use of threats. Yet that was exactly what they had done. Why? What made them feel strong enough and powerful enough to treat a councilman of Terminus in such a fashion? Could it be Earth? Was the same force that hid the world of origin so effectively, even against the great mentalists of the Second Foundation, now working to circumvent his search for Earth in the very first stage of that search? Was Earth omniscient? Omnipotent? Trevise shook his head. That way lay paranoia. Was he going to blame Earth for everything? Was every quirk of behavior, every bend in the road, every twist of circumstance, to be the result of the secret machinations of Earth? As soon as he began to think in that fashion, he was defeated. At that point, he felt the vehicle decelerating and was brought back to reality at a stroke. It occurred to him that he had never, even for one moment, looked at the city through which they had been passing. He looked about now, a touch wildly. The buildings were low, but it was a cold planet. Most of the structures were probably underground. He saw no trace of color, and that seemed against human nature. Occasionally, he could see a person pass, well bundled, but then the people, like the buildings themselves, were probably mostly underground. The taxi had stopped before a low, broad building set in a depression, the bottom of which Trevise could not see. Some moments passed, and it continued to remain there, the driver himself motionless as well. His tall white hat nearly touched the roof of the vehicle. Trevise wondered fleetingly how the driver managed to step in and out of the vehicle without knocking his hat off, then said with the controlled anger one would expect of a haughty and mistreated official, "Well, driver, what now?" The Kamporalian version of the glittering field partition that separated the driver from the passengers was not at all primitive. Sound waves could pass through, though Trevise was quite certain that material objects at reasonable energies could not.
The driver said, "Someone will be up to get you. Just sit back and take it easy." Even as he said this, three heads appeared in a slow, smooth ascent from the depression in which the building rested. After that, there came the rest of the bodies. Clearly, the newcomers were moving up the equivalent of an escalator, but Trevise could not see the details of the device from where he sat. As the three approached, the passenger door of the taxi opened, and a flood of cold air swept inward. Trevise stepped out, seaming his coat to the neck. The other two followed him, Bliss with considerable reluctance. The three Comparellians were shapeless, wearing garments that ballooned outward and were probably electrically heated. Trevise felt scorn at that. There was little use for such things on Terminus, and the one time he had borrowed a heat coat during winter on the nearby planet of Anacreon, he discovered it had a tendency to grow warmer at a slow rate, so that by the time he realized he was too warm, he was perspiring uncomfortably. As the Comparellians approached, Trevise noted with a distinct sense of indignation that they were armed, nor did they try to conceal the fact. Quite the contrary. Each had a blaster in a holster attached to the outer garment. One of the Comparellians, having stepped up to confront Trevise, said gruffly, "Your pardon, Councilman," and then pulled his coat open with a rough movement. He had inserted questing hands which moved quickly up and down Trevise's sides, back, chest, and thighs. The coat was shaken and felt. Trevise was too overcome by confused astonishment to realize he had been rapidly and efficiently searched till it was over. Pellerat, his chin drawn down and his mouth in a twisted grimace, was undergoing a similar indignity at the hands of a second Comparellian. The third was approaching Bliss, who did not wait to be touched. She at least knew what to expect somehow, for she whipped off her coat and, for a moment, stood there in her light clothing, exposed to the whistle of the wind. She said, freezingly enough to match the temperature, "You can see I'm not armed." And indeed, anyone could. The Comparellian shook the coat, as though by its weight he could tell if it contained a weapon, perhaps he could, and retreated. Bliss put on her coat again, huddling into it, and for a moment Trevise admired her gesture. He knew how she felt about the cold, but she had not allowed a tremor or shiver to escape her as she had stood there in thin blouse and slacks. Then he wondered if, in the emergency, she might not have drawn warmth from the rest of Gaia. One of the Comparellians gestured, and the three outworlders followed him. The other two Comparellians fell behind. The one or two pedestrians who were on the street did not bother to watch what was happening. Either they were too accustomed to the sight, or more likely had their minds occupied with getting to some indoor destination as soon as possible. Trevise saw now that it was a moving ramp up which the Comparellians had ascended. They were descending now, all six of them, and passed through a lock arrangement almost as complicated as that on a spaceship, to keep heat inside, no doubt, rather than air. And then, at once, they were inside a huge building.